Hey gang, this is Rocky from What's the Fuss Podcast. You're listening to Something Something Cast. I just want to take a quick moment to let everybody know that all of our t-shirt sales from now until Halloween go directly to the Yellow Brick Road Foundation. This is a foundation dedicated to helping kids with congenital heart defects, and it's a great way to give back. If you want to go right over to whatsthefusspodcast.com, pick out a t-shirt you like. I won't make a cent. It all goes to the kids. Thanks, guys.
Okay, here we go.
Okay, here we go.
Welcome, everybody. It is time again for another episode of the Something Something Cast.
Something Something Cast.
I'm James Hatton.
I'm Podcast Rob.
Hi, sir.
Hello.
We actually now don't do the episodes so close together anymore. It's weird. Now I can say, how you been?
Yeah, not too bad.
That's great. You know what? I'm going to jump right into our sponsor, and then
Who are we sponsored by?
We are sponsored by, funny you should ask, audibletrial.com/something. I was waiting for an ooh.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Excellent. I didn't want to interrupt.
Oh, fair enough. So
riveting.
All of our faithful listener, you can go to audibletrial.com/something and you will get one free audiobook and all of the discounts that the subscribing members get for 30 days. That includes discounts on podcasts such as other ones than ours, because I don't think we're on Audible.
We have to fix that.
Yeah, we totally should fix that. But podcasts, radio, news, as well as a huge library of books, such as this month we are talking about Amazing, Fantastic, Incredible, a marvelous memoir written by Stan Lee, Peter David, and Colleen Duran, as narrated by Peter Reigert and Stan Lee. It's Stan Lee's memoir. And I'm sure our special guest will have stuff to knows a thing or two about this, or at least knows its existence. But if you want to hear the story of how Spider-Man and X-Men, and hear stories about Kirby and all this other stuff, or potentially just arguably ignoring him entirely, you could go to Amazing, Fantastic, Incredible, a Marvelous Memoir at audibletrial.com/something with a dozen other like really great superhero history books. I wanted to put a superhero fiction book in here, but funny enough, none of the ones I've read have made it to Audible yet. But there are a bunch of great Christopher Golden books, and he did some of the X-Men fictionalized novels years ago. So check him out, too. audibletrial.com/something.
Are you saying we have Stan Lee as our guest?
No. No, someone much more important.
I was about to dust off my Excelsior.
Would the mystery guest please sign in?
Good evening, everyone. I'm Tim Stevens, also commonly referred to as the Stan Lee of today. And I just want to let everyone know that in the parlance of the X-Men movies, I'm the future, Charles. Stan Lee no longer matters.
I didn't know Magneto just specifically hated Stan Lee.
He is really a dick about it.
Super swole.
Yeah, absolutely. Gave him a stink palm once.
How you guys doing this evening?
Doing good.
Brother, it's wonderful to have you back. I'm doing well. It's
my pleasure to be here.
It's our pleasure to... I don't know how to end that.
So, to have me here, yes.
Sure. Right. Yeah, we'll go with that.
To have me here.
But yes, it has come that time of year again where one of the Netflix originals has reared its ugly head, or pretty head. We have yet to decide. And of course, we have to call our expert of all things Marvel, the Marvelous, Tim. And I think
here I am.
I think you're more the Stan Lee of tomorrow, today.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Means you're going to have to come up with some sort of picture so you can update your Twitter. That horrible Black Bolt mask is a little old, I think.
Yeah, I changed that, sadly. When he didn't cast me, I changed it in a fit of rage. But having seen the Inhumans, maybe it's best I didn't get that role.
I did not watch Inhumans. Is it as bad as the world is speaking? I didn't have high hopes for it, just given the what I know of the Inhumans as a whole. There's very few Inhuman stories I really like.
The Inhumans are the hottest IP of the past 10 years, and that's all I have to say about it at this time.
Fair enough. As hot as in, please don't touch it again?
Well, after 8 episodes on ABC, they might go for a little sleep. That's all I'm saying.
Right. And yet Peggy Carter only gets that one half a season.
Such a good show, though.
Yeah.
Bummer.
We are going to be talking about The Defenders, though.
Indeed we are.
Rob, what'd you think to start us off?
I mostly liked it. I wasn't sure after Iron Fist, I really wasn't sure how I was going to feel about Defenders at all. But it seemed interesting that 75% of the core of the Defenders seemed to feel the way I did about one Mr. Danny Rand. So that kind of made the first bunch of episodes, I don't want to say tolerable, but entertaining, that they all seem to have that same kind of feel about it. I think it was good that it was a group because we didn't necessarily linger on any one person too much.
Mm-hmm.
Which maybe kind of shorted Daredevil a little bit, although I do think we see him more than most of the other three. Mm-hmm. But because we have to juggle back and forth between all four of them, I don't think we get tired of any one character. So that was kind of nice to be able to have each other be a palate cleanser. And I think it was fun to see them kind of come together and realize, hey, look, you know, we can work together. Maybe we should work together and let's see how things go.
Yeah, I probably the way you're saying it, I think I liked it a bit more than you. I think it has some flaws, but I think for doing what they did as best as they could to showcase everyone. With, yeah, I agree, Daredevil is sort of the centerpiece, but the Danny Rand stuff, which I'm sure we'll talk about at length, was so good. So good. The everybody against Danny.
Yeah.
Danny Rand's band against the hand. But I at the end of it, I looked at it and went, I like this more than the internet is telling me they liked it. So I give it at least a thumb and a half up. Not as good as the best that Netflix has done, but definitely above the middle.
Yeah, just before I give my opinion, I just want to be clear. Is the reason after Iron Fist you were nervous about this is because you just felt like nothing could live up to that, Ryan? Rob, was that the concern? That you just felt like after Iron Fist...
Where do we go?
Yeah, Citizen Kane has no meaning anymore.
No. It was actually it was quite the opposite. If you had listened to our Iron Fist episode,
I was there. I didn't.
That doesn't mean you listened to it. Hatton doesn't listen to our podcast. We've been doing it for 4 years now.
I'm not listening to you
to
now.
Every episode I'm on, I always fast forward to the parts that I'm not talking though.
Oh, see, well, there you go. No, I was nervous about it because I really liked Daredevil. I was okay with Jessica Jones. I didn't know how crazy I was about Luke Cage, and Iron Fist was fairly disappointing for me. So putting them all together, it was like, I wasn't sure. Very excited when we first heard about the project after we had seen all the separate ingredients. I wasn't sure how I felt about how it was going to pan out. So I guess pleasantly surprised also could be because I went in with fairly low expectations. But yeah, I think it did have some flaws to it, but it was still all right. I would still recommend it to people, you know, even after they've maybe did or did not like certain aspects of the individual shows.
Yeah. I mean, I agree that, yeah, I think that's a fair estimation, that it's not, it's certainly not a perfect product. But after Iron Fist, I felt like it really, I don't know. I didn't lose the faith, so I wouldn't say that, but I think it was a nice way to sort of reaffirm that there is a plan here, and that was a bump in the road. It's not a trend, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I was worried, out of all of the characters that I was concerned about, because I knew, I mean, when you look at the four of them, Daredevil, Luke Cage, Danny Rand, and Jessica Jones, the one I was concerned about in the mix was Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I dislike Jessica Jones, quite the contrary. It was more that her tone was so drastically different than the other three characters. They're all heroes, and then she's sort of a reluctant hero. But I think they played her reluctance, probably my favorite character arc of the whole show.
And I think it helped because the Daredevil we encounter at the start, at least, is also pretty reluctant to be.
Sure.
He's reluctant, period. Like, he's reluctant to be doing what he's doing, but he's also reluctant to put back on the mask. So in that way, they have a similar positioning, at least at the start of the
right.
show.
No, that's very true. And then on the quite the contrary, you have Luke Cage and Rand, who are both super ready to get back to work or do whatever mm-hmm. they can. And they're, when they first meet each other, Luke Cage speaks from the heart of the internet and yet the world. I loved that they nodded so quickly, because that's like episode 2-ish, where they yeah. have their sit down, and he just calls him out for the privilege and mm-hmm. says, you're just a rich white boy, all of that. I liked that they got that out of the way to let us know, look, we heard what you were saying. We get it. Let's work forward. Which I think gives them a lot of good faith for the future of Iron Fist, if he has a moral compass in Luke Cage.
Right. And I liked that Luke Cage, you know, sort of read him well right off the bat. But at the same time, it wasn't just purely one way. Like, the show makes it clear that Danny is naive and that Danny is sort of leaping before he looks. But at the same time, that he does have a moral center, and that he's not, you know, despite what Luke Cage says, he's not just wandering the city looking for minorities to beat up. But at the same time, he's not assessing the full situation. He is so blinded by his desire to hurt the hand that he's not looking at, like, the guys in the hazmat suits that are cleaning up the murder scene. How much do they really know about why they're there? You know, does it help to punch them over and over again in the face, or is there another way to do this?
Mm-hmm. Rob?
No, I definitely agree.
I mean, Danny was never better, never more likable, or never as likable in his own show as he was in, 3 minutes talking to Luke Cage about dumplings in the Chinese restaurant scene. You know,
yes.
It's like, that's where you just felt like the show really knew how to handle him in a way that Scott Buck and the first season of Iron Fist really didn't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They definitely got to the... I think it was easier, too, because now that there's... Those of us who are in the know are familiar with the Power Man Iron Fist comic books, or at least that they had kind of teamed up and they had their little buddy group going. So I was kind of waiting for the moment for them to try to plant those seeds. So that whole scene where Danny's basically, you know, tied prisoner to the chair and Luke is watching him, you could kind of see that start to come to fruition a little bit, at least the beginnings of it. I thought it was very cool that the way they did that.
You mentioned the restaurant, because I saw one of the complaints that I've seen is people complaining that the one episode, almost, you know, for an 8-episode series, it's almost a ship in a bottle episode. The whole thing takes place in the restaurant. I thought that was super unique.
Mm-hmm.
That episode, what is it? Episode three.
Three,
ends,
yeah.
Yeah, three with ends with them getting to the restaurant, and they don't really leave the restaurant until entirety, till episode 5.
Right, when they're forced out, essentially.
Yeah, it's... I understand it feels like sort of stretched out storytelling in a show that really condensed a bunch of stuff quickly. But I thought that was it was such a neat way for them to force them all into interact, give you some cool set pieces for action, and show each of their individual characteristics. She leaves, Danny Rand sits and has some food. You know, it all worked really well for me.
Yeah, I've also, you know, heard a couple of people complain about, you know, they sit around in a restaurant. I could have lived there for 3 episodes. Like, just the way they interact with one another just felt so pitch perfect to me. And what it reveals about the characters I thought was really useful. I understand it's a superhero show and they weren't punching stuff for the most part. But at the same time, I just felt like we learned so much about where they were and hinted at where they might go. I just thought they really did a nice job.
Yeah, I sent a... What was it? Which episode did I post that after? Probably 4 is the episode where they show up at the top of the skyscraper and the meeting's there, and the next episode begins the big old fight. But it's that moment where you're like, oh, they're the Defenders. Woot!
Right.
And that first... I guess we'll call that the first act... I thought that was the first act of the show I felt was almost flawless.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way they got the group together didn't feel contrived. It felt like all of them were there for a purpose. I mean, even if there is some contrivance, you know, there's going to have to be just for the
right. You're putting 4 people together, you know, just by its nature.
Right. So I thought that first act really, it couldn't have been done any better to set us up for what was going to come next.
Right. I mean, like you said, everything that brings them there makes sense with their characters. You know, Jessica Jones can't let go of a case. That's why she ends up at that skyscraper. Daredevil can't stop protecting his clients, so he follows her there. Luke Cage is still working on that. The kid from his neighborhood that died.
Yes.
He's still following up on that and trying to set that right. And Danny Rand is... obsessed with the hand, so he's trying to force out the last bits of it from his company. So, like, they all have real and established motivations for being there. Nobody is like, Daredevil's there because he happened to have a meeting on the floor below or something like that. There's no...
Right.
How do we throw the last guy?
The thing that I did like, too, is even, like you said, there is some contrivance. There has to be. But even though we saw some of that in this series, a lot of those dominoes had already been pressed in their independent shows.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would have felt more contrived and shoehorned together if we didn't see any of those connections until the Defenders show started. Because with only 8 episodes, they really would have had to force fit things. But since we're basically seeing follow-ups to stuff that we had kind of seen start in their independent shows, I think that forcedness was minimized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tend to agree.
I would say the only thing I felt my biggest weakness, I think, was... And I think the understanding is if you're watching The Defenders, you watched everything that came before it, which... Mm-hmm. Fine, I'm on that. I feel that the need to put every secondary character from all of them in and not... They didn't all have subplots, but they all had a beat. It felt like they were trying to get every single one of them to have a moment, which if you're thinking about this as a big blow-off movie, I understand why they did it. But some of them felt like... I don't really need to see Jessica's neighbor as much, or I don't need to see Luke Cage's who was it? The crime boss, what's her face?
Mariah.
Yeah, Mariah, thank you.
The congresswoman / crime boss, yeah.
Yeah, I think they could have left some of them out. I don't even know which ones. Because it felt like there was a minute there where I was turning around and every one of them, like, going through the Rolodex of my brain going, which person was this? Which person? Why are they important to me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only one that I really had a hard time with on that front was Colleen Wing. And not because I don't like the character, I actually like her quite a bit, but in this show, there's no reason for her not to be a defender except for the fact that they haven't organized their, you know, like the whole point of this was to get the four characters together. Colleen Wing is on par with all of them in terms of her abilities and things like that. So there's no reason for her not to be part of the group, except for that's not how they built this machine.
Mm-hmm.
So, she unfortunately is forced into a lot of corners where she has to like sit around and do nothing or just switch characterizations from one moment to the next. You know, she's the one who initially says to Danny, they should seek out other people like them to help with the hand. And what is it? An episode and a half later, she's complaining to Danny about the fact that he's hanging out with the other defenders. It just felt like they didn't know what to do with her. And they might have been better served by just chucking it all and saying, look, we have a fifth defender.
I would say the only thing that separates her is she doesn't have a superpower per se, but I don't disagree with you. She's the fifth wheel, and she doesn't mm-hmm. get her big show-off moment the way she probably should. Yeah,
right.
No, I'm with you.
I mean, if they found a way to sort of gracefully sideline her, it might not have been as noticeable, but they kind of don't, so she keeps almost being part of the action, and then something happens to move her off the board. You kind of wish they committed one way or another. You know, it's not obviously the best thing in the world to have one of your prominent female characters hurt in the first act and taken off the table, given history of comic books and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it might have served the character better if, for some reason, like she had to take on her old sensei earlier in the season, and that sidelined her for several episodes. Might have been a more elegant way of dealing with her. Or, like I said, just go all out and say, like, she and Danny are a package deal. We have five defenders. We don't have four.
Yeah, and you're correct that the only reason really that didn't happen is because she doesn't have a named TV show yet.
Right.
By the end of the series, they nodded very heavily towards her and Misty, which super happy about that.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I'm psyched that they are being hinted as, you know, beginning their partnership, and I'm excited to see the robot arm in action. But it felt so funny after how close they came to her losing her arm during Luke Cage,
mm-hmm.
and how sort of like organic is not quite the right word, but you know, they organized beats around it. It seemed like that was going to happen, and then it didn't. And then in this one, it's, you know, a flick of a sword blade and she loses her arm.
Yeah.
It was so sudden, as opposed to it had this nice buildup in Luke Cage and then they pulled back, and here it was like, we'll just give her the robot arm after all, I guess.
Which, to someone who, what I think what's great about that is the difference between people like us who know what happened to Misty Knight and mm-hmm. a casual fan who has no clue about her sort of her arm and Iron Man and all that. That's foreshadowing.
Right.
You know, that's really good foreshadowing, in fact. It makes them look like they had this long plan about her arm where we're like, come on, just do it already. It's edging for us.
Right.
Rob, any thoughts?
I really liked the Misty Knight thing. I was not aware of the whole robotic bionic arm
Ooh.
That happened with her. So when I saw that happened, it to me that was like, well, that seems fairly severe for a thing to happen to somebody who is as important a secondary character as Misty Knight is.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing some Googling, and then I was like, oh, well done. Well, I was pretty happy with that. As far as not everybody needing their own little curtain call from all the other shows, I completely agree. I would have been more than happy to have Jessica Jones's neighbor just end up on the cutting room floor. To me, he was just the most annoying fucking thing ever. What we know about how short and curt Jessica can be, it felt almost out of character when she walks into her office and he's there and she's like, get the fuck out. And he's like, no, I think I'll have one of your beers instead. That she wasn't like, excuse me, I said get the fuck out, and like throw him down the hallway kind of thing. At least slide him down the hallway. It seemed like the forced comic sidekick kind of thing. And I wasn't crazy about him at all.
Yeah, I mean, the point of him is very literally that she doesn't do that, though. Like, it's Jessica Jones doesn't grow very quickly, so you have to show the small, subtle ways she grows, and one of them is she tolerates this guy in her life, whereas 6 months... the timeline's a little weird.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna mention that, please.
Because if... From what we learn about Jessica Jones, she hasn't taken a case since Purple Man, since the end of the first season. But there are signs that it's been multiple years. So are we to believe that it's been like she's hanging out in this apartment? Like, her not fixing the apartment's pretty in character, but her not taking a case for 2 years seems unlikely. So I'm not entirely clear on that part of it. But in any case, his presence is the way we get an indication that her heart has grown perhaps half a size.
But and I get that he was supposed to be like a message to show that she has grown, but I don't know. He didn't have to be so annoying to do it. He grated on me every time he was on the screen. It was just one of those things.
Fair enough.
Yeah, the timeline is, so we know how long Luke Cage was in prison? Because that's sort of the one time meter we have. I don't think they ever really say whether, you know, because he could have gotten out on good behavior. He could have done his whole stint. I don't remember if there was ever a number given to it.
The implication is somehow Foggy's the law firm he works for,
yes,
somehow got him out early. But what early means, I'm not entirely clear on.
Right.
I mean, I know he turns himself in at the end of Luke Cage, but I don't recall what the charges even were, unless it was he was fulfilling the sentence that he initially escaped from. Like, the idea was that he was turning himself in for essentially being a fugitive. So I don't know. I don't even have like a crime to clock the average amount of sentence that, you know, someone would have to serve under the circumstances. Mm-hmm.
And that's, I do think it was the fugitive issue that he was wanted for the things, you know, of the past. So,
right.
I personally, you know, there's right. So many details and that are lost in my brain now that,
you know, he's. And if Foggy's law firm could prove that he was experimented while he was in that prison, and that's, you know, that led to his escape, you know, he might have only served a few months, which would make sense. However, like I said, there are certain indicators that Jessica Jones' series happened a bit ago, and that doesn't really fit unless, like I said, she's literally just not had a source of income for 2 years, which seems unlikely.
Right. Yeah, I don't, because it doesn't make sense why any the one or two sort of good friends she had would support her even that long. I mean, a bit, sure, but...
Right. And also, Misty Knight's reaction to her makes it seem like, not that it was yesterday that she killed Purple Man, but it's been within the past 6 or so months. Like, everybody seems to know who Jessica is in a way that nobody's like, why do I know that name? So it feels like it must have been pretty fresh.
Yeah, it was a very much, oh, it's you again, not a, well, I haven't seen you in a while. It's subtle differences.
So yeah. I'm perusing through this article while I'm listening to you guys on where it's Defenders Timeline Explained.
Ooh.
They basically say Jessica Jones's story is the furthest removed from the beginning of the Defenders.
Right, and I just don't see how that could be.
Like, I think but even still, they're only talking like matters of months.
Okay, that makes sense to me.
Because they said they're saying basically the short answer is Defenders takes place 1 month after Iron Fist, a month and a half after Luke Cage, and 2 months after Daredevil season 2.
Okay.
Basically because they show 2 months earlier when we see Elektra reemerging as Black Sky. So we know that was basically 2 months after that. And they're basically showing that some of Jessica Jones kind of overlaps with certain aspects of other shows. So they're trying to like piece together where that.
And well, I'm sure that
Harlem, when Claire moves to Harlem, that's it's referenced in Daredevil season two. But then we see that in episode 5 of Luke Cage where she's moving there. So they're trying to like Lego everything together.
Right, I was going to say that's the one thing you have to take into account is we saw them chronologically, but there's no indication that necessarily unfolded in sequence. You know, it's entirely possible these things happened at similar times, you know, not simultaneously necessarily, but there's no reason that Daredevil couldn't be in the midst of season two at the same time that Luke Cage is becoming the hero of Harlem.
Yeah, yeah.
Or whatever the case may be. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, if you told me Daredevil season two happened a year before Defenders, I could see that. And maybe that would make more sense in terms of his sort of addiction arc that they have him going through, you know, his recovery arc as it was. You know, they do a lot to make it seem like being Daredevil is as if he is addicted to an illicit substance that he's recovering from and barely holding onto the wagon. And Luke Cage, again, would probably benefit from a little more time just because a month and a half is incredibly quick to get out of prison, even if you were experimenting on last time you were there. Whereas Jessica Jones feels like it should be more immediate, but it is not for me to say, I suppose.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, because even Luke didn't seem like amazingly shocked that he was being released from prison.
Right.
So you would almost get the sense that maybe he was in there for 6 months to 8 months, and this was just like his time to be released, you know, be it for good behavior or whatever. But one would think if it was like a month and a half at some point, he'd be like, damn, I just got here. Okay. Argument for me.
His reaction to Foggy's appearance is as though this is not the first conversation, not say with Foggy, but the first conversation he has had with that law firm.
Right.
Like, it seems like there is an established relationship there, even though he is literally meeting Foggy for the first time.
Right.
Because he has that great line about Foggy says his friends call him Foggy, and Cage's response is, and you let them?
Yeah.
It's in their best interest to leave it vague. Just in case people, now that those shows are on the network and they're just on Netflix,
right?
You can go visit them and watch them individually. And somebody watching Iron Fist first would have a very different timeline in their brain. So I can understand why they did it that way.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing you have to worry about is Rosario Dawson's character makes vague references to other characters. She's aware of their existence.
True.
But again, if you take the approach that there's no reason that events couldn't be happening simultaneous to one another, that's not that big a hurdle.
Yeah, and it's not like the movies haven't had some wonky timelines either. There are still people trying to figure out exactly where Doctor Strange fits into the whole timelines. Like, we have some vague ideas.
Right.
But that's comics, though, right?
Like,
no, exactly.
Every 10 years that goes by in comics, we have to slide the scale because otherwise, you know, for instance, Punisher literally being a Vietnam vet doesn't work because he'd be in his 60s now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, Captain America has the benefit of being in ice. So it's just, right. He's been in ice longer.
Exactly. I was going to say, even that changes, though. Like, initially he came awake in the middle of the 60s, and now it's, I think the official thing is like sometime in the late 90s, which is kind of bizarre to think about that Captain America woke up sometime around the time I was graduating from high school.
Right.
But,
and, fuck, I'm old.
And and if you consider that, strangely enough, there will be a point in time where he woke up after 9/11, which makes it a very strange sort of...
Yes. That's a very good point.
That's so weird. So what do we think about Sigourney Weaver?
Well, first, her introduction, the hospital she's in was about three blocks from where I lived in the Bronx.
Really?
Yeah, I was equidistant between two hospitals, a teaching hospital and just a regular hospital. And I can't remember which hospital it is. I But in any case, one of the two hospitals she is, that's where they shot those scenes. And the woman who walks her down the hallway is a Connecticut resident, actually. She's an actress who lives most of her life in Connecticut. So there was just all sorts of connections to me in that opening.
Does everybody in Connecticut know each other, like a small village?
There are
know each other, but I know everyone.
There are many cities in Connecticut that are like that, though.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I believe the term is quaint.
Yes. To answer the question more directly, I liked her performance overall. They don't give her a ton to do, but she's Sigourney Weaver. She really fills out the character with only a few things. And I liked the surprise. I appreciated that there was no hint of what was coming from the materials we got in advance, from the way she in interviews she was presented and that sort of thing. So I liked that.
Yeah, I mean, Sigourney Weaver is a wonderful actress, especially in a big character piece like this. So to have her where she rarely plays a big villainous sort of character, Ghostbusters aside, to see her play, an upstanding person as villain, I thought they did her eccentricities really well. The conversation very early on where, she's clearly balls rich, so she has the private music conversation where the violinists or celloists, I don't remember, were playing the pieces of music, and she's speaking very specifically to the audience about, when Brahms wrote this, we can tell she's speaking from memory, where the other character in the scene is thinking she's just very, very erudite. I loved how nicely they told that to the audience while keeping it vague within story.
We'll try to talk more about colors later, but they really do some interesting things with colors in terms of her wardrobe, which starts as pure white.
Yes, very stark.
And then we start to work in more earth tones as the story goes on. I can't remember what she meets her eventual fate in, but I believe it's either green or brown. So, like, there is this sort of sense that as she is growing sicker, so too are her clothes reflecting kind of the spreading toxin.
I was really interested. You know what? I didn't really pay attention as severely to the color palette in this one as I have in the other Marvel shows, because I just assumed, given it was all of the characters, there wouldn't be as much of a nod to that. But that's very, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, as long as we're on the topic, they do some really interesting stuff, especially early in the season. So, like, they all have their signature colors. The first interesting thing is that Jessica's isn't purple anymore. It's more of a blue, which is showing the sort of lifting of his influence, which is, that's a nice little touch. In Daredevil's, the red never touches him when he's first introduced. So he's in that diner, I believe, is when we first see the red glow. And it's reflecting on the tables and stuff like that, but it literally stops before it reaches him, which is an interesting way of indicating that he isn't Daredevil right then and there. However, by the end of the first episode is where the earthquake happens and he runs out into the streets, right?
Yes.
That, when he's walking down the hallway, he's completely bathed in red light at that point. And that's also the first time maybe that's the second episode, but in any case, whenever the earthquake happens, that's the first time you see other colors. So in his scene, you see the blue and the yellow, which makes sense because both of them are also dealing with the earthquake, and you don't see the green because Danny is largely disconnected from it. He just lands the helicopter at the same moment. So there's some very interesting stuff that they do with that, especially early on in the season.
Yeah, it'll have to be on a rewatch that I look out for, because I did notice Luke Cage in his yellow shirt very quickly, which, given what you're saying, makes tons of sense. You know, he came out and he was ready to be Luke Cage.
But if you just watch, I think literally the first two or three episodes, it gives you the idea of the color, and that's the best stuff in terms of the color stuff. And then once they're together, that largely fades because it would just be garish to have that continually happen. But I do like, especially in terms of Daredevil, how it indicates initially that he is avoiding that, and then when the earthquake happens, he re-embraces it, even though he hasn't put on the costume yet.
As far as... So one of the neat things I did catch, pardon me, is when they go find the plans in the piano.
Mm-hmm.
So my one question is why Daredevil goes to the piano in the first place, but that's... If anybody can answer, that'd be wonderful. I had a Daredevil-y guess, but the song he plays is that opening theme.
Yes. Yeah, he plays the Defenders theme.
Which I thought I liked that, because it's obviously not a famous piece, but I did do that moment, and I think that's what they wanted you to do, is to go, well, that's really familiar. What is that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's the thing they keep playing at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah. And I liked it, you know, it's distinctive and it's simple. I think he mentions that scene playing it while he was a choir boy.
Right.
So it makes sense that it's a simple piece that he would have had the ability to play, because I don't think he ever formally learned so much as, like, he was probably just playing around on the piano. And now that, you know, he's Daredevil, he has a much better pitch. I'm curious what's your Daredevil explanation for why he went to the piano? Because I have a guess as well, but I'm curious what yours is.
Well,
I suspect yours is more interesting.
Or completely bonkers. First, that means he would have to recognize that there's a piano in the room.
Right.
So we would have to assume that he uses his Daredevil-y senses. And if you've ever walked in a room with a fairly large piano, there mm-hmm. is, it does have a certain reverberation when you walk by it. The mm-hmm. strings will vibrate. Just a normal person walking by, you will know, you will feel that you are walking by a piano. So I can dig that.
Right.
So if he could walk by said piano and notice that the feel is off, like there's something within the piano,
mm-hmm.
because I have to believe that he went to the piano knowing there was some, that the blueprints might be in there. Can't imagine it just being hey, can I go tickle your ivories? That'd be fun.
Oh, no, I agree. It's definitely not that. For me, the vibrations of the piano, I think, makes sense. The other thing is that she just references at one point that her dad doesn't play piano anymore, or that he stopped playing the piano. And so I think it's less Daredevil skill and more detective skill that leads him to say, oh, that's funny, he stopped playing piano. But actually, it makes more sense if it's sort of both at the same time. Like, he walks by and he notices the vibrations are probably a bit flat. And then she mentions that, and the combination of the two make him think, oh, maybe I should take a look at that piano then.
Together we have solved this puzzle.
Yes, we are the best.
Yeah, it also seemed, it was interesting to me the way, because when he did start playing the piano... Like, I am nowhere near Daredevil level hearing, but you could easily hear that there was, like, crumpled up paper on one of those strings when he hit that one note.
Sure.
So the fact that he hit it a couple times and kind of looked questioningly, like, well, gee, that doesn't sound right. And had to get, you know, do you hear that? Does that sound like, it almost seemed like he was overdoing it, because clearly we could hear that there was something mm-hmm. jammed in there. So it's almost like he was trying to cover up for the young girl
the previous knowledge that he had.
Yeah, that he had kind of figured out why he was going to the piano in the first place and what he was going to find there.
And if I know my Bugs Bunny cartoons, if he had slammed on that key two or three more times, that whole piano was going to explode.
Probably. Yeah, I want to touch on something real quick before, because Tib was talking about he knew the hospital. This is what happens when you have a number of notable movies filmed in a certain city.
Mm-hmm.
So this is from, I'm just reading this from Den of Geek. When Alexandra is listening to her private classical music concert, she's overlooking Columbus Circle in New York City. If you walk out the front door of that building, hang a left, and walk two blocks, you're in front of the building that she lived as Dana Barrett in Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look across the park from that, you'll see a tan apartment building, which was where Lois Lane's apartment was in the 1978 Superman movie.
I didn't know that one. That one's cool.
So there's a lot of stuff going on in New York City.
Yeah, the two hospitals in question, by the way, are Jacoby and Albert Einstein. and I'm not sure which one's which. But as I said, I lived on Yates in Brooklyn, and they're equal, or in the Bronx rather, and they're equidistant from my apartment. So, one way or another, I was between them.
And they knew you.
Yes.
So, as far as other villains go, I mean, she was really the primary villain. They're the sort of the sub villains. I liked the inclusion of Gao. We're dealing with the hand here, so it's almost inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say I was disappointed that there wasn't a Kingpin, because I really feel they're holding him back on purpose
for
full effect. I think I might have, even though I complained about the complete amount of characters, a nod. I don't know, maybe it might have been too much since it had nothing to do with him whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get to the end of the episode, it clearly is heading that way. But
yeah, I mean, there was a moment where I thought he might be the wild card, mm-hmm. that they might strike a deal with Kingpin to overthrow the hand, which wouldn't have been terrible, but I didn't mind the way it went down either. I really like D'Onofrio's performance, so it would have been great to see him again.
Yes, and I'm with you that there was a moment where, like, when is he? Come on, they gave you everybody else. They're mm-hmm. all here. But I think he is intentionally conspicuous by his absence.
Yeah, I am inclined to agree.
So, as far as Easter eggs and all that wackiness, did you catch anything cool? Because I got one.
Okay, go for it.
I beg to differ, Mr. Okay. Stevens.
Oh,
all right. Not that I
caught them, but
let's see what you consider Easter eggs. But what was yours?
The one I did, and I saw somebody post a sort of zoom in on it, is in the scene with Misty Knight and Colleen Wing,
mm-hmm.
on the dry erase board behind Colleen in Misty's hospital room. It says Al Carter, which is the name of the original Night Nurse.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's the one I got. I'm out.
That's a good one.
There's that marker board goes so much deeper, though.
Is it a hatch?
Not yet.
I got it this time. Yeah.
There is a Dr. E. Wortham on there as well, which is believed to be Elias Wortham, known as his supervillain name Cardiac.
That's the best. I love Cardiac.
The doctors who are supposed to follow up on Misty are Dr. Tony Isabella and Dr. Arvel Jones, which are Misty Knight's creators.
Mm-hmm.
The phone number, 555-1975, is the year that Misty's first appearance came out in Marvel Premiere 21.
Jiminy.
There was a lot of stuff on that marker board that I was looking at.
The person who dispenses her medicine is a Dr. Spachemin.
But there's some other things in there too where it says the nuns are told to get Maggie.
Oh
yeah,
we're gonna get to that.
That's a big thing.
Okay, all right.
I mean, it's not just who she is, but what that scene connects with. So are we gonna say that, Jamie, to probably the last thing?
I was figuring we were gonna save it to the last thing. I do want to ask you, Mr. Stevens, I need to know everything about Cardiac now.
You need to know everything about him?
Is he a Daredevil villain?
No, he's actually a Spider-Man villain, predominantly.
Okay.
His brother dies because of inadequate health care. and he's a doctor at the time, and he decides that he's going to step outside the law. Some sort of ionic thing he puts into his heart that powers his suit, and he has a staff. And essentially, his first couple of stories were him trying to take down, like, corrupt pharmaceutical companies and things like that. He's actually more Punisher than villain, truth be told. Most recently, he worked with, when Spider-Man was taken over by Dr. Octopus in Superior Spider-Man.
Yes.
One of the people that Doc Ock hired at his fledgling company was Eli Wortham. So he became he was still Cardiac, but he was also an employee of Parker Industries for a while.
All right.
Excellent. And that's the most recent time he's shown up. But he is amazing, and I love him.
As, as a note, Rob, I apologize for cutting you off with Maggie there. It's just saving that moment. Did you have any other points?
No, that's fine.
Okay, I realized it was rude.
No. It just that was in fishing for Easter eggs. There are some other ones throughout the entire series, but there was a specific shot of that marker board, and then there was like 8 bullet points underneath that of everything that was on that marker board that they think is referencing something else. So when you mm-hmm. brought it up, I was like, I wonder if he realizes how deep that rabbit hole goes.
I didn't catch the year thing. That's cool, though. I think this is the first time that we get the name of Stan Lee's police officer that keeps showing up everywhere. He's Irving Forbish, which is a reference to Not Brand Eck, the parody comic that ran back in the day. And Irving Forbish, or Forbish Man, Red Long John Ennings had, and he's a parody character. Here he's been recast as a police captain who shows up on all those If You See Something, Say Something posters.
Yeah, I didn't notice it until I saw it on a picture. I didn't notice that he was in there. It's so fleeting.
Yeah, this one was... he's kind of looking down the barrel of the camera. It's definitely bigger than the past couple ones, but there's a lot happening in that scene because that's when Daredevil's following, or Matt Murdock is following Jessica Jones. So there's a lot of people, and he's doing a lot of, listening and smelling and things like that. So there's a lot of business to distract you from what's happening, mm-hmm. Or from that, I should say.
Is any other ones of note?
For Easter eggs?
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
They keep teasing the size, obviously. Which is Elektra's weapon of choice. That's supposed to be a sign that she's sort of getting back her memory. We talked about the bionic arm. We talked about Night Nurse.
They did say towards the end of the season, Danny Rand is portrayed a lot in a gray tracksuit with like a green shirt underneath it. Which they feel might be an homage to kind of the current Iron Fist costume.
It
looks very tracksuitish.
Yeah, I wish they give... If only to balance the team out, like, it's pretty obvious when the four of them are together and Daredevil's the only one in costume.
Yeah.
So I do wish they'd hurry up and give him a more proper costume. But his last... his last scene is very reminiscent of what he's wearing in the comics right now.
Yeah. I almost want to say that they actively acknowledge that with Jessica when she looked at Daredevil at one point and just went, oh, back in that again? Okay.
Yeah, she definitely lampshades it. And also, actually, Colleen Wing wears sort of a tracksuit version of what she wears in the comics, the very white... tracksuit she wears is very close to her current costume.
That's my favorite Colleen Wing costume.
It's a good one.
So why don't we discuss the end bit, which is it tells the tale of the future pretty clearly.
Yeah, I mean, they've put all the pieces on the table at this point. It'd have to be ridiculous not to go for it, I feel like.
So, we are speaking of the scene in the hospital with the nurses and whatnot, right when you find out that he's alive, mm-hmm. which leads me to believe also that there's a good chance that Madame Gao and Elektra are alive. I'd hate them if this would be Madame Gao's end, so I really have to hope she's back.
Yeah, I'm almost certain Madame Gao is. We'll see on Elektra. At least what condition she comes back in. That's what I'm curious about. You know, there's... She's had a few resurrections, so there's some interesting ways it could go.
But yeah, that scene is literally a full, almost a panel shot of Born Again.
Yes, yeah, it's almost exactly pulled from Frank Miller's rendition, not Frank Miller, actually, David Michelli drew that. But yeah, it's right down to the dialogue, actually. The Maggie thing is from the comic as well. And so at this point now we have a very motivated Kingpin who is out and we're not sure up to what. We have Nuke in play and we have this scene, which would suggest also that his identity is known by more of the people than it should be. So it's a pretty straight line at this point if they want to go that way, and I would say that it's probably a pretty good idea if they do.
Yeah, given, I mean, when we went through season two, when we were talking about it, we were like, they seem to be building all the pieces for it. Now they just, I really feel like solidifying it with a full first page. It's not, I don't think it's first page of the series, but it's the first page of one of the issues.
Yes. Yeah.
Of that.
I think it's the third. I mean, obviously this would be out of order, but in the actual, Born Again arc, it is a turning point for him,
right,
towards taking back his life. But here I think it might just be more the kickoff.
Yeah. This, if what I would like is if the next season of Daredevil really starts here,
mm-hmm.
You know, I really don't want much time to pass between the two. Maybe recoup time. But I would be perfectly content with him still being in the nunnery when we come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Rod, so let me please pose this to you, the two, out of the three of us, you two are clearly the much bigger Daredevil fans.
Mm-hmm.
I will not say I read in depth Born Again, but I did, I will say, blitz through it because it is fairly dense on the dialogue.
It is.
But yeah. it's a good story. I get it. I enjoyed it. It is also kind of like hallowed ground on Daredevil stories.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any trepidation from Daredevil fans that if they go this route, is it flying too close to the sun? Is it, you know, it cannot be done justice from paper to screen, so it's going to turn out disappointing people? Is there any fear of that?
Well, we're talking comic book fans, so of course.
So it's already garbage.
Well, but I'm not, but I consider myself not talking to comic book fans, talking to you in Hatton. So you are more, far more intelligent, level-headed creatures. Yes, the base plebes will light their torches and grab their pitchforks at anything that they don't like. But I mean, just to parallel this, when I realized that the Avengers whole, the MCU was drifting towards the Infinity Gauntlet story,
mm-hmm.
I was very excited and amazingly concerned because there's a lot of pieces that need to get put into place before something like that is done. And then how accurate are they going to be? How many liberties are they going to take? How many of those liberties are going to take away from the story and minimize the impact?
Yeah.
Those still hold true, even though it's a different story. There's still stuff that has to get set up in the Daredevil universe in order for Born Again to have its impact. So do you feel they've done enough, and do you feel that the payoff can be worthwhile to honor the story that was put on paper?
Well, the thing about Born Again as a unit of story, it is, I don't know if it's cinematic is quite the right word for it, but it can be well adapted, I think. I don't think it would take a lot of work to transition it from page to screen in a way that other storylines might. There's not a lot of characters involved in it. Action-wise, really, this, you know, in terms of transitions for the characters, you basically have to take Daredevil from low to his absolute lowest and then back up again. So all that stuff I think you can do pretty easily. And in terms of setup, there's not a ton. Like, all you need to know is Kingpin's out for blood, which we know. Daredevil has told some people his identity and gotten a little sloppy with it, and he is physically reeling. Like, if they take Jamie's idea and start right from the end of this storyline, you know, he's not in great shape. And I think in terms of that, they are at a good place. There's always a risk that they botch this kind of thing, of course. But so far, in terms of the liberties and the way they've changed things, they've all, for me, felt okay. You know, like making the Hand a sort of renegade member or breakaway members of Kung Lao is not what it is in the comics, but it was a nice storytelling element to connect the two and to sort of cut down on having to explain things. You know, it made sense in the world of the Defenders. And so there's been little things like that here and there that aren't comic book faithful, but have been, I think, adaptations that didn't change your ability to tell the story, but made more sense from a standpoint of you can't just, you know, have an infinite number of these characters who have no connections whatsoever. But I don't know. How do you feel, Jamie?
To tag on that, what I find interesting, you brought up a very good point that I didn't really consider, that one of the aspects of Born Again is he does get a bit sloppy and has revealed himself to a handful of people. And, I mean, if you look at that, that's the Defenders.
Mm-hmm,
you know, exactly. That's a really, it's already a good spot that now there are four more people, minimum, that know who he is that could let it slip by accident. Foggy's literally just, you know, walking into the police station with a duffel bag with the Daredevil costume. There's a lot of potential there for this guy to tell this guy to tell this guy to tell this guy to tell Kingpin.
Mm-hmm.
As far as could I see it going horribly wrong, I have more faith in this than if you were to basically start this on its own or with any other group. And that's only because they've done an amazing service to Daredevil to date.
Mm-hmm.
So with those actors, the Born Again is one of those stories that a bunch of people have already tried to retell. Like it seems to be, after Frank Miller did it, it became the obvious story for Daredevil. Well, let's take away everything he's got. Let's reveal one of his things. Let's get rid of this thing. It almost became a Daredevil trope.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they've laid out enough cards that even if they just go the most basic tropey version, it's still going to be pretty good with who we got.
Right.
I
agree. I mean, for me, it doesn't have to be an exact pastiche of Born Again to work. You know, there's things that aren't going to be in it that are going to bum me out. Like, I love the part in Born Again when the Avengers show up, because there's that great line of narration about Captain America having a voice that can command the gods, and does. And then they have Thor show up. You know, that's great dialogue or narration there, but I'm not going to be sad if it, for obvious reasons, doesn't make the Netflix cut. I think you can tell the essence of Born Again, which is Matt loses it all, literally, nearly loses his mind, and still manages to turn the tables.
Yeah, it's... And my biggest weakness in Born Again, which we've discussed, and I understand the function of it, why Captain America comes in and is the one that faces against Nuke. They're obviously going to have to change that, because Cap ain't showing up. But
And for you, that'll help, right? You won't have to deal with that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I think that they've set out a good reason for Danny and Luke and Jessica to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And they've given a, you know, Daredevil did this and he stood by us and he banded us together and he's the sort of unspoken voice of, in some way, or at least the unspoken compass. So I could definitely see them fulfilling that role. Let's protect who's protected us.
Right. And, you know, part of the reason Captain America takes on Nuke is... Nuke is the twisted sort of updated version of them trying to make a Captain America. In Netflix universe, both Luke Cage and Jessica Jones for that matter, and Nuke are the product of, I can't remember the company's name, but the experiments they're doing. So you can still have that kind of dynamic, which is Luke Cage took these abilities and is doing the right thing with them. Nuke took these abilities and has used them for personal grievances, has lost himself to drug addiction, et cetera, et cetera. So you still have this kind of the virtuous version of the experimental results and the twisted, out of control version. It won't be the same necessarily because they won't be wrapped in the flag at the time, but you can still tell that aspect of the story.
I'm with you. Does that sate sort of the question there up?
Oh yeah, no. It's, I just feel it's a valid question to ask.
Oh, 1,000%.
Oh, definitely.
I know how revered that storyline is by a lot of not only just Daredevil fans, but comic book fans.
Mm-hmm.
And any time you touch on something like that, I was the same way when, you know, we finally heard they were getting a Watchmen movie. I was like, man, this is either going to be really good or it's going to be a shit show. I don't think there's a middle ground on it. And I think any time you go with a medium or a story that is revered by a large number of fans and people, that you can potentially run into that. So I just wanted to bring that up and get some intelligent and well thought out Daredevil fans' thoughts on it.
Yeah, and it's 100% a valid question, because you aren't wrong. That, I mean, even Wild Pig Chris, who is probably one of the most historically knowledged comic book fans I know, it's his favorite comic ever. So that at least says something about it. So, Rob, I know you didn't see it, but I did want to ask Mr. Stevens' opinion. Did you watch the Punisher trailer?
I did see the Punisher trailer today, yeah.
Yep. Since you haven't seen it, Rob, I won't get too heavy into it, but it's super bloody.
Yes.
So they're clearly going a much darker route, which I'm okay with because it's Punisher. I hope that doesn't mean they're going to segment it even further.
Right. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think it depends on the way they tell the story.
Yeah.
But I can easily see that it is particularly bloody and gruesome early on, and then slowly transitions to perhaps less so as he becomes more mainstream or sort of settles those scores. But we'll see.
Yeah.
I really like Jon Bernthal's performance.
Yes.
So I'm really excited to see him as a character that I don't generally love, but that doesn't mean that it still can't be well done.
Yeah. I'm also not a huge Punisher fan. I think he's almost too easy and sort of easy to make a pandering comic out of.
Mm-hmm.
So he was great in Daredevil, so I look forward to seeing how they keep the story interesting without it just being sort of a run-and-gun, explodey-explodey, bullet-bullet-bullet, very lack of story. But the trailer doesn't give you anything more than that, but I can't deny that trailer was super fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think it seems assured. They know what they're doing. The only thing I kind of bumped on was the reference to the CIA conspiracy, just because from his appearance in Daredevil, it seemed pretty straightforward what had happened. But I'm intrigued by that, given that his commander at the end of the Daredevil arc, there is some indication that things were a bit more complicated than Frank was aware of.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And Rob, I recommend seeing it, if only for the sort of music cues.
Yes, they did a really nice job with the music. Some stuff that really fit that you haven't seen pop up in a million trailers. So.
Yeah, they use, without revealing much more than this, they use One from Metallica.
Okay.
Which is a war song anyway. It's very about sort of the perils of war.
Is it played by like a 500 piece orchestra with a little girl doing the lyrics in a very slow kind of almost like funeral march procession kind of pace?
I think it's the original track, right, Jamie? Like, it's not even a cover, right?
The first part is it has him playing it on an acoustic for the first few notes,
right,
just to sort of make you go, is he playing? And then it gets into the real track. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. It just seems to be the thing lately in trailers, where we're going to take like a pop song or a rock song, and we're going to have it played by an orchestra at a very slow pace, and mm-hmm. have some little girl do the voices for it.
Mm-hmm. Especially, it's weird when they start doing like typo negative songs, because then it's
exactly. You're just like, what? Whoa!
It's redundant at that point, isn't it?
Kill all the white people. So, do you have any other questions for Mr. Stevens about the Daredevils? I figured I'm out, so if you had anything else.
Yeah, I'm pretty good.
All right. You know, just in the Daredevil vein, the speech he gives to that Kitty's representing in court at the beginning of the episode one, I think, is really great. It's he talks to him about how... people are going to continue to pity him and continue to try to do things for him, and things may never get better, but you have to use your anger to make things better, which is a very Daredevil thing, especially a Frank Miller Daredevil thing.
Yes.
About harnessing your anger, because otherwise it's going to just make you, it's just going to ruin you.
Who did he give that speech to?
The kid in the wheelchair.
The kid in the wheelchair, yeah.
Great. Yeah, it's very early on. Okay.
Yeah. It's, you know, he's fully in attorney mode, but it shows that he's still Daredevil.
I did notice that the sequence of him going to save Jessica was almost right out of Alias.
Yes. Yeah, it is, actually.
Yeah. They did it so well that without, you know, looking it up, without seeing it, I went, wait a minute, this is from the book. I can just tell the framing, yeah. Everything,
the shot selection, everything. Like, he walks into the room, and I think the shot of them at the interrogation table is almost pulled exactly from the comic.
Yeah. Well, that leaves.
Yeah,
us.
there were a couple places that had that side by side with the comic book page, and it looked pretty spot on.
Mm. I'm gonna have to go look some of those up because I love seeing that.
Yeah. Let's see what other stuff. Elektra, her emergence from whatever you want to call that thing, the rebirthing chamber. There's a lot of Dracula echoes in that. It's very Nosferatu with the hand emerging and that sort of thing.
Sir, I know comics. It's called a Lazarus pit.
Not in this case.
Somebody had also, on one of the articles I was reading, somebody had also said that the kanji that's on the coffin is the symbol for resurrection.
That makes sense.
Neat.
But also shows that people are doing their homework, too.
Right, yeah.
You know, it doesn't just say, you know, fried egg. And somebody's just like, okay, it looked cool, so we put it on there.
Yeah. Villains-wise, we started to talk about it, and we stopped with Madame Gao. It was nice to have the Colleen Wing Sensei back. And to hopefully be done with him for good, but I thought it was nice to bring him back. He did not come across as well as he came across in Iron Fist, unfortunately. I think maybe because everybody else was just doing a better job and he was doing the same he was before. And I liked the I can't remember the character's name, the hunter character, the guy we see eviscerating a bear when we first meet him. I liked him as a character.
I have to remember his name, damn it.
Let's see
I can do a quick search. Nope, nothing.
And yeah, so I think they were all interesting, but also I was fine with the fact that they were all kind of cannon fodder at the same time.
Yeah, I think they did a good job of giving you enough of the sort of sub villains to be barely capable mini bosses when compared to how they all were now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To build up to what they have to deal with.
Do you like that, this is directed to Rob, do you like that Iron Fist is wearing his suits better this time out?
It shows that he's giving himself, that he's become more established in this universe, that
yeah.
he's adapting better and realizing, hey, you know what, I can't buy off the rack anymore.
Right.
So yeah, that was a nice touch.
I knew the first time around you were bothered by his discomfort in his suits, so I noticed when he shows up in the boardroom that he's like, oh, he got himself a tailored suit. That's nice to see.
Yeah, well, it also shows, again, it shows he's taking more control of his company, more control, or attempting to take more control of the direction of his company.
And he literally looked older to me. Like, not like he looked 70, but like he looked, you know, with his hair shorter and the stubble more maintained. He looked like he had grown up between seasons, which I think is kind of an accidental thing from everything I read in terms of how much they knew about Iron Fist going into Defenders, you know, what they were going to do in Iron Fist. But I think that did a nice job of showing that, like, it might have been a couple of months, but he has grown.
He has made some better personal choices in those past couple of months. No, exactly. I completely agree. And whether it was accidental or not, it did kind of set that tone where, you know what, he realized that he came in super hot and heavy in the very beginning. So now he's had a chance to take a step back, reassess his position, make some little tweaks, and come at it in a more adult and professional manner.
Right. And at the same time, it showed that he is still pretty immature, because the moment he starts to encounter pushback from doing exactly what he wants to do, he is back to being that 10-year-old again.
Right.
But that didn't bother me, because I felt like that is a character flaw at this point. That makes sense to me, that he is, when in times of stress, he reacts like a child because he still hasn't really dealt with everything that's happened to him.
Right. So that's the knee-jerk defense. It's the,
right.
The nature over nurture kind of thing. So yeah. I was okay with that too.
And I liked the fight between him and Daredevil. I thought it did a nice job of showing both characters as dangerous for different reasons. And actually, I liked the fact that, and maybe this happened in previous seasons I didn't notice, but Daredevil's fighting stance is a boxer's fighting stance. He doesn't use a martial arts fighting stance. So that was nice to see a subtle contrast between the two.
I don't think I noticed anything.
Just talking about the fights, too. I wasn't crazy about the fights in Iron Fist. I super wasn't crazy about the fights in most of the fights in Luke Cage and Jessica Jones, because they don't really have a form. It's really just, hey, I can't be hurt and I'm really fucking strong.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the group fight scenes, especially towards the end when they're fighting just wave upon wave of the hand, I think those fight scenes were really well put together, because we only saw kind of glimpses and bits and pieces of Luke Cage and Jessica Jones when their power slash skill set made sense to everything else that was going on. We saw a little bit more of Danny Rand, but most of a lot of the fight scenes were Daredevil. And that was fine with me, because he's probably the best choreography-wise that they have out of the entire group.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like anybody got left out.
I think
knowing what we know of their fight styles and how good each individual person is, we saw just enough of the right amount of everybody's fighting technique to be okay with it.
Right. And I did think that Finn Jones did a better job on fight choreography this time. Either they just knew how to shoot around him better, or he had more prep time. But it did not look nearly as awkward as in the Iron Fist, which was nice.
I also think a lot of that comes from the fact that we weren't just focused on him. We were bouncing back and forth between a lot of the other people. So you can make up for a lot of that by, we're not seeing 45 seconds of him fighting. We're seeing 15 seconds of him, and then 38 seconds of Daredevil, and then 5 more seconds of Finn.
Right.
Kind of nice little palate cleansers.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And it also did a nice job of showing, like, how Jessica Jones and Luke Cage could be befuddled by ninjas in terms of, like, yeah, they can take the bullets and so on, but you still have to put that guy down. And, you know, as she says at one point, am I the only one who doesn't know karate at this point? Like, right. You can imagine, you know, being super strong is great, but if she can't get a hold of them, if she can't land a punch, then that fight just goes on forever.
Yeah, the moment when they fought the wave of ninjas in the restaurant, and then here comes the wave of gangsters, all with, you know, fully automatics, and everybody drops except for Luke Cage, who just sort of hunches over and takes the whole sort of brunt of it.
Right.
I liked that as the moment to say, oh, okay, he don't got it on the ninjas, but holy shit, he'll stop all the bullets. I will say that out of the fight sequences, when they sort of did their, hey, this person, all, the classic comic, before they're friends, they have to fight each other. I enjoyed the Iron Fist Luke Cage fight pretty decently.
Yes.
I thought they made them both, I like the way that they said they showed us that each of their powers sort of doesn't negate the other one, but definitely they bring them to the limit of their power just when they're working against each other.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That's sort of what was I going to say here? That's kind of what I meant in terms of like Luke Cage being able to resist this kind of attack, but at the same time not being able to stop them.
Right.
You see that really up close with Iron Fist is, you know, Iron Fist can't put him down, but at the same time, Luke Cage can't put a hand on him. So it's this constant back and forth between the two until he busts out the Iron Fist, which is the first time I felt like we got to see the Iron Fist that, except for when he punched the wall in the third or fourth episode of his own show, that you were like, oh, okay, this is a really dangerous weapon. Right.
I will say, when they were in the restaurant, the whole we have to fight before we can be friends, where Iron Fist punches Luke Cage and like everybody gets knocked down from the like the reverberating shockwave that comes off of it.
No, that's later when they're in the when they're trying to convince Danny that he needs to not leave the warehouse because they're the one he's the yes. one they all want.
Okay. That whole thing was very reminiscent to me of the Thor and Iron Man fight in and Captain America fight in Avengers.
Yeah, actually, you're right. That is that same.
It had that like it felt that kind of epic where it's literally the immovable force and the irresistible object basically colliding at that point, and it was very cool not only to see that effect, but then to see everybody with that kind of holy shit kind mm-hmm. of look on their face afterwards.
And also it did a nice job. I thought the fight did a nice job of showing individual personalities. Like you have Daredevil is at this point angry and very driven to protect Elektra. You have Iron Fist being the sort of impotent child. Luke Cage trying to be a peacemaker. And then Jessica is the one who eventually puts Iron Fist down because Jessica just... she just stops things. Like when right. she gets annoyed enough, she fixes or stops the train. Because she can't be bothered to pull her punches or to try to solve it some other way. She's done with it and it's going to be over.
Yeah, yeah.
That that whole sequence where, you know, it's, I guess we'll call it the twist of the show is that Danny is not so much a bringer of unity to the Force. He is a physical key that opens up. I liked that as a mm-hmm. plot twist. Mm. 'Cause it gave Danny importance while also minimizing him as a person too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're continuing to hit this note that it's very clear. And I hope they get into this in season two. For whatever reason, they did not do a very good job of training him.
Right.
And if it's because he left too soon or they only wanted to make him a weapon so they didn't bother to do the stuff that they should have done with him or any other number of factors, I guess, that I'm not thinking of at the moment. I like that they keep coming back to this idea that essentially they strapped a nuclear bomb to his wrist and then they told him, we'll get back to letting you know how to use that thing at some point. because time and time again, it's shown that he has no idea the extent of his powers. And also, beyond the fact that he can hit stuff with it, he doesn't really know what he can do with it.
Yeah, I agree. What I wonder is if that has been supremely planned for, or whether that's almost not a retcon so much as a... It seems like after the first season, they said, all right, let's solve the Danny Rand problem, like the writers mm-hmm. did. And it seems that they're going whole hog on the, look, this is why he was the way he was then. So it's if you watch it, it makes more sense knowing now. You can look mm-hmm. back and go, all right, I guess that is the alpha stage of what we see now, because there was so much weakness in the Iron Fist series.
Right.
That... they clearly spent some time to evolve how they thought about Danny Rand.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I would have liked a better series just out of the gate, but yes. If they use that to tell a story of somebody who was given this tremendous gift, theoretically, by a group of people who refused to tell him how to do the right thing with it. And, you know, him trying to puzzle that out on his own, that's not a bad way to tell a story. And it's not going to, in retrospect, make season one better, but it might make our appreciation of him increase. And I think it already has, you know, if you look at least for me, but also if you look at reviews and how they talked about him, I think it's done a lot to show that there is a story there. It's not just, even if it started with, we cast this poorly and we chose a really lousy showrunner, they've made efforts to integrate that in a way that makes sense for a character.
Now, let me ask you something else, because you brought up something that I had completely forgotten was a sore point with me.
The punching the wall?
God. Yes, it serves to show that he's not, that it's easy for him to fall back into his old patterns and become very, very single-minded in certain things. You know, a friend of mine used to joke about, you know, getting into fights, you see red rats. Everything just goes red. It's just about the fight. Nothing else matters. Mm-hmm. You're not really processing anything else. But literally, the second he got into that room, I'm yelling at my computer monitor, they're going to lead you towards the wall. They're going to lead you to stop heading towards the wall. They're taking, you're at the wall. Don't punch the wall. Holy fuck, you punched the wall. What the? Like, you can see it coming from a mile away.
Yeah, I do wish they had found a better way to do
it. It felt a little ham-fisted when they finally got there. Yeah, they could have done a more subtle way about it, but there was no doubt in anybody's mind, except maybe Mr. Rand's, about the outcome of how that whole thing was going to go down.
Stupid Rand's hand.
Oh, it was just one of those things where, you know, if they were going to throw me for a loop and he goes in to punch her and she moves and he stops like a split second before it and realizes what's going to happen and she, you know, they realize, holy shit, he didn't do it. So somebody like spinning heel kicks him in the back and forces him into the wall. That I would have been okay with, because he realized, hey, maybe this is why they lured me dead. Oh, fuck, I tripped kind of thing. But just the whole, oh, she moved, I'm going to punch the wall. You're just like, oh, for fuck's sake, dude, really?
Yeah,
a little bit more cajoling, I think, would have been better for me.
Yeah, I almost, you know, I don't know exactly how you would have done this, and I don't like to be the kind of person who says, like, they should have done it this way. But I was kind of hoping the moment that he would do it on purpose, as a demonstration of, like, A, taking control of his destiny, like Alexa's talking about, but B, that he trusts his friends to have his back. So, like, he doesn't have to worry about this thing getting out, whatever's in there. So he's going to remove himself as a dangerous object by just doing this. You know, that would have been fine. Like you said, some other reason than just, I don't have a problem with Alexa outplaying him, but it's so obvious what's about to happen.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, any other way. Your way is the equivalent of the hostage shooting themselves.
Right.
You know, to take them out of the equation. And I would have been fine with that, too. It's just, and it's not just this show. It's anything. When you can see what they're trying to set up, the whole maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't, from 5 miles away, and there is no intersection or jug handle or off turn from the road that we're on. It's like, look, you can fake and toy, ooh, is it going to happen, all you want. We all fucking know it's going to happen.
Right, yeah.
That was the one thing. Once you mentioned that punch in the wall, I was like, oh, wait a minute. That was the one thing that was really like, come on, guys. We were going along so well.
Yeah. One thing, sort of a flaw, if we're in that vein, you know, I think they did really well with the colors. This is the first series that I thought the music wasn't that great, though, unfortunately.
It's sort of forgettable.
What's that?
I said it was sort of forgettable, really.
Yeah, I thought they said some really interesting, especially in terms of Luke Cage and Iron Fist, given their particular music interests in their series. I thought they could have done some really interesting things sonically, and they just didn't put much effort there, which was a little disappointing, because I think the other series have done nice work with it.
Yeah, I think they very easily could have come up with some sort of mashup between all four of the musical styles of the individual show. And had some really nice stuff going on. I mean, I've heard some ridiculously different genres of music mashed up together in something that's like, okay, you know what? That's not too bad. I think they easily could have done that with the four of them and had something that worked.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, and it's not the end of the world thing. It's just something that when you've done it well in other series, it just stuck out to me.
No, absolutely. When you make a certain number of gains, and then the one thing that you did good before you let slip in order to make those other gains, it's
right.
The loss of it is far more noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm with you.
Well, with that, I think we've kind of covered the gamut of the Defenders.
I agree.
I think we have.
So this leads us to Mr. Stevens. As always, I'm going to ask you, have you been reading anything really interesting?
Well, I think I spoke about this last time, but Ed Brisson's still writing the Iron Fist series that, like I said, we talked about, takes some of the costume inspiration from. It's a good book. It's a really good book, actually. So if you want a decent Iron Fist story told in the current times, I would check that out. Let's see. Mr. Miracle just started, written by Tom King. He did Vision over at Marvel first, which was a great series, and now he's doing Mr. Miracle, and that's awesome, too. I would definitely recommend that, even though it's from the Distinguished Competition.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, everybody, all of the Defenders right now have good books. Daredevil's been very good. There's a new Luke Cage book written by the guy who was writing Power Man and Iron Fist, David Walker. The Iron Fist book is good, and Jessica Jones is being written right now by Bendis. And while it's not living up to the heights of Alias, it's a pretty strong story. So if you like these guys, there are stories involving all four of them that are worth checking out.
Bendis is the guy who should write. I mean, he writes the best Jessica Jones for obvious reasons.
Right.
Is it closer to the, which era of Jessica Jones is it kind of lingering closer to?
Oh, it's definitely more Alias than, say, The Source. Oh,
okay. There we go.
And actually there is the next arc Purple Man comes back for. So if you're looking to jump on, that might be the one to do it with. But they're doing some really interesting meta storylines right now, because I don't know how aware people are, but Marvel came out of a crossover called Secret War that reordered the universe a little bit, and some elements were lost, and there are a few people who remember that, and one of them is Jessica Jones. So right now she's dealing with having this information that other people don't seem to have and figuring out what it means for her and what it means for the larger Marvel universe, that there's this sort of there are gaps that she seems aware of, and a few other characters like Miles Morales is aware of, but not necessarily being, you know, she has super strength, but she doesn't necessarily have the power to move the planets. So, you know, how is it when you're one of five people that knows the world is wrong? How do you fix it when you're just one person? Which is, you know, obviously a bigger thing for her, but it's told in a very Jessica Jones style, so it really keeps it low to the ground.
And that came through from Secret Empire?
No, from Secret War.
Secret War, okay.
Last year's crossover, I guess.
Gotcha.
And she was largely unaffected by Secret Empire, which is for the best.
Right, I heard Secret Empire was a bit of a cluster.
I mean, I think your feelings vary, but just the nature of that story, I don't think there's a lot of space for a character like Jessica Jones.
Yeah, no, it's too sort of politically minded.
Right.
So do you feel that Secret War is one of those crossovers you can pick up and read without having, you know, gone through pre-Secret War Alpha Complex? And then...
And the main series, I definitely think you can. If you want to do that kind of thing, it's written by, I just blanked out his name. Hickman, Jonathan Hickman.
Right.
So there is a lot of stuff that you can look back at his previous books that, like, oh, he set that trap here and here. But if you just want to read the 8 issues, I think it is, of the main series, it tells a complete story. You know, all you need to know is there has been a event that's made this world, and they cover that in the first few pages, and everybody's trying to figure out why
these segments of different universes have been crushed together as one planet being ruled by Dr. Doom. And that's all you really need in terms of prologue.
You know, I started on that. And I started on the reading the, you know, pre-Alpha Omega Complex. And just with the Break World stuff. Or is that even before?
Yeah, I mean, that plays into it. Like I said, okay. Hickman builds and builds and builds. Yeah. So, you know, there are echoes throughout that. Like, if you read, you know, his Avengers book, for instance, you'd be like, oh, I recognize that from that. But he did a nice job of telling, if you just read the Secret Story, and honestly, that's what I would recommend. You know, there are people that love Hickman and love what he did on the Avengers. I'm not really necessarily one of them. And I think you can drive yourself a bit up a wall if you try to follow his beats exactly.
Sure.
In some ways, it's just better to cut to the climax in terms of Secret War and just say, like, I'm just going to read the part where there's the fighting.
Right. Well, I mean, I tried to read Hickman's, what was the end of his big Avengers run, the Interspace, everybody.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the event, the crossover that it was, but I read that, and having not read his previous 4 years of Avengers, was, oh, who are these guys? Are they just meeting them? Oh, nope, they've known them for a while. Wonder what they... Oh, they're dead now. Were they the reason every... I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's sort of what I mean. It's like, unless you want to be... Infinity's the thing you're thinking of, by the way.
Yes.
If you're going to be in, you know, the expression in for a penny, in for a pound, like if you want to go all in, you can do that. But you literally have to go all in if you want to do it. Otherwise, just skip to Secret War.
Noted. Anything else? Any other good ones?
Nothing that I don't feel like I've recommended before. If you like Batman, Batman's going through a really good time right now. In terms of Marvel stuff. There's a couple of like fun books at Marvel right now, like Squirrel Girl and Gwenpool, that are not necessarily traditional. Gwenpool in particular is an incredibly meta story. That's a lot of fun with some serious beats. And Squirrel Girl is consistently
right.
Blast. So if you're looking for something a little bit lighter, a little bit with a female voice, for instance, or you just something a little untraditional, those are great books to pick up too.
Yay. And if people were wondering, where can I read more from this beautiful, beautiful man, where would you tell them to go? Meaning Tim Stevens.
Marvel.com 3 or 4 times a week usually has stuff from me. My website, timstevensisungage.com, has a variety of things. There's always a Tuesday list. This week I talked about the week that we're recording. I can't tell you what happens in the future. But this week that we're recording, I talked about there was a court case in which a monkey took a selfie. The man whose camera it was, you know, understandably, it was a great picture, sold it to several different outlets, and then got sued by PETA because he stole the monkey's art. PETA lost the first case and appealed, and this photographer's first name is David. I can't remember his last name. In any case, finally decided to settle. So the money actually goes to, like, monkey habitats, but I decided it should go directly to the monkey, and I gave him financial advice about how he should spend that money. And I'm also in the midst of something called Beholding Bigelow, which is a career retrospective of the director Crafton Bigelow. Most recently directed Detroit, but has done Strange Days, Point Break, After Dark, or Near Dark, rather. So I've been going through her films one a week, and I have two left. I have Strange Days, which is arguably her best film, in my opinion, and Before Dark, or Near Dark, which is one of the best vampire movies out there. So I'm pretty excited about those last two.
Yeah.
So those are the big things there. And last but not least, nationofnerds.com. For a little bit, at least, I'm doing a column a week, just freeform pop culture stuff. This past week, I wrote about doppelgangers, specifically Batman's, and then waxed philosophically briefly about what my doppelganger might be like. And this coming Sunday, I don't know exactly what I'm going to write about, but it's going to be about Punisher and my ambivalence towards him as a character and towards the way, say, police officers and the military has embraced him as a role model.
You do a lot of work, sir.
You do. I'm exhausted just listening to you.
Are you sure it's just not my my voice is soothing you and making you feel comfortable?
I mean, it could be. I fall asleep to a lot of Neil deGrasse Tyson and Bob Ross, so maybe it is just the dulcet tones of Tim Stevens just kind of puts you in that relaxed.
I know you mean you listen to their recordings, but I love the idea of Neil deGrasse Tyson just coming over to your house, sitting on the end of your bed.
Oh, absolutely. And he just
reading you a story.
Not even it's the phone book, dude. It's literally whatever's around the back of a shampoo bottle.
Yeah, he just tells you about his day.
Listen to Neil deGrasse Tyson pronounce isochlorothiazolinone is just like right out. Done.
He tells you, you know, and then I started my day with an English muffin, and you're just...
It's gone. Methylchloroisothiazolinone. That is the longest ingredient in a bottle of shampoo.
Oh, interesting. Do you know the longest word in the English language?
No.
Ultramicroscopic silicone volcanoconiosis.
Okay. I'm not gonna challenge you on that.
It's a disease. It's kind of like a black lung kind of thing.
Oh, gotcha.
I guess I beat out anti-disestablishmentarianism. You know. I'm sorry, we're now all talking at once. What was that?
I was saying, and now, dear listeners, you know the longest word in the English language, too.
Absolutely. And people are going to go look at a bottle of shampoo, and they're going to look at the back, and they're going to go, holy shit.
That's the thing about the something-something cast. It's basically like going to high school. In fact, hey, just drop out of school, kids.
And only sometimes not like getting pushed into a locker.
Oh, we're going to come to your house and push you into a locker. Don't worry about that.
It's okay. I got Neil watching my back.
And that's how you can get your something diploma.
Absolutely.
Send $9.95 and...
Tim, thanks again for coming on the show. Always a pleasure having you on and rapping about Marvel and stuff.
The pleasure has been all mine, ladies and gentlemen. And to you, Rob, and to you, James, always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir. And when the Punisher comes, we'll send you a message to find out whether you're completely sickened and don't want to do that, or when we will see you next.
Oh, I'll be up for it. I just might be all fussy about it.
Ooh. Oh, that's fine.
Fussy.
That's fine. A dissenting tone is always welcome.
Yes, we'll have to swaddle you first, but past that, we'll be good. Right.
Ooh.
My prediction is I will like the show, I will like the acting, but I will still think that Punisher is a morally reprehensible character whose popularity continues to confound me.
I understand. I can't wait for that discussion. Until then, thank you, brother. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Rob, do you got any other follow-ups?
Nope, I'm good.
Well, then let's just get on with the getting off. This is...
Whoa.
That's not what I meant.
Whoa. At least turn the microphone off first. Dude.
Been James
Hatton. At least ask for consent.
I've been James Hatton.
Yeah, if you sell the audio recording of this, where does the money go to? Does it go to the monkey?
The monkey, yeah.
It all goes to the monkey. I've decided to make him the beneficiary.
I'm Podcast Rob.
I'm Timothy G. Stevens.
We will
and
see.
You've had a great time.
The G stands for...
Gage.
Bye.
Yeah, come on, you know Sanford and Son.
How old do you think I am?
Nope.
But you're familiar with the term. Clearly, not as old as I thought you were when you were talking about graduating high school in the '90s.
No, I am familiar with. I can do this theme song from Sanford and Son, but
no,
I.
But he always thought he said Frederick G. Sanford. The G stands for, and every episode it was something different. So when you said Tim G. Stevens, it was like, and the G stands for.
Well, in my case, it's always Gage.
Okay, fair enough.
G-A-G-E, like the scary kid from Pet Sematary.
Gotcha. Or one half of Tenacious D.
Oh, that's right. It's, yeah, it is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you go.
So I'm Podcast Rob.
Oh, I'm James Hatton.
I'm Tim Stevens still.
Okay, bye.
We'll see you guys all next time.
Come as you are, as you were, as I want you to be.
think the four of you can save New York? You can't even save yourselves.
Is this you?
Is what me?
I'm on with you, and I was getting a phone call from you and Tim.
That's really funny.
And again,
feel free to answer it.